From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, former MSU and USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar admits to raping seven young gymnasts.
I think this is important, that what I've done today to help move a community forward and away from the hurting and let the healing start.
Detroit artist Carl Wilson using powerful linoleum prints to tell overlooked stories.
We're so insensitive to what happens to our fellow human. And that is the cruelest thing that you could imagine.
The key to breaking the chains of loneliness.
Finding your tribe, finding your people.
And the first Detroit Lions Thanksgiving Day game.
Detroit met the undefeated and defending champion Chicago Bears that first year in 1934 and lost 19-16, but a tradition was born.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Dr. Nassar. Or Mr. Nassar, if it's more appropriate, what would you like us to know?
I think this is important, that what I've done today to help move a community forward and away from the hurting and let the healing start. That's a couple of things that I could do to stop the hurting is this, and I think that's important.
For nearly 14 months, Larry Nassar insisted the way he had touched young female athletes was accepted medical practice. Today, the former MSU and USA Gymnastics doctor stood before Ingham County Judge Rosemary Aquilina. He pled guilty to raping seven underage gymnasts by putting his ungloved finger inside them for no medical purpose, against all medical protocol, and that he fully knew they were too young to consent.
And I pray the rosary every day for forgiveness for I want them to heal.
Judge Aquilina turned the focus onto Nassar's many victims, some of whom were in the courtroom.
I agree that now is a time of healing, but it may take them a lifetime of healing while you spend your lifetime behind bars thinking about what you did in taking away their childhood.
Sentencing will be January 12th, and it may run for several days to give all the victims who wish to a chance to make statements. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells was in that courtroom today. Kate, what was the mood, especially among Nassar's victims?
I think it's the most surreal court hearing I've ever been in. I mean, you looked around the room. First of all, that place was packed. There were two dozen reporters, cameras from every major outlet. And then in the room itself, in the courtroom itself, the place was just packed of women and girls of all ages. Some of them, you know, were with their husbands. Some of them were so young that they brought their dads, and at one point one girl just sort of leaned her head on her dad's shoulder while Nassar was pleading guilty. There were tears. There was an enormous amount of tension. I don't think any of this feels real to anybody yet.
Some of the victims in these pleas were under 13 years of age, others aged 13 to 15. What are the sentencing possibilities?
So with this plea deal, what Nassar and the AG's office have agreed to is a minimum sentencing of 25 to 40 years on each of these seven counts that he's pleaded guilty to. Part of that deal, however, is that these can be concurrent counts. So they can essentially, all those sentences can be served at the same time. Now, as the judge noted in court today, that she's not part of that plea agreement. She's not bound by those restrictions. But if she does decide to go over and above in terms of sentencing, Nassar has the option of withdrawing his guilty plea. And essentially, this all goes back to square one and they're back to a pretrial.
And we know this doesn't end Nassar's legal problems. What's ahead?
Oh, so many things. So as we heard from Judge Aquilina today, all 120 women and girls who have come forward to MSU police about Nassar, they will be given an opportunity to make a victim impact statement. You mentioned that that's going to be sentencing is in January. Then at the beginning of December, he's got a federal sentencing hearing where additional victims will be allowed to talk about the impacts on their lives. The federal sentencing is going to be for the charges on child pornography possession that he pled guilty to over the summer. And then, of course, there's these civil cases that are still playing out right now that are in mediation with more than 100 of these women and girls and MSU and USA Gymnastics.
Well, now, Kate, we're seeing the criminal part of this story kind of coming to some kind of conclusion, at least regarding Larry Nassar. How much attention is being turned now to Michigan State University and its administration when you think that the acts that he pled to go back for years and years while he was employed at MSU?
I think the heat on MSU, if they felt it was intense before now, it's about to get that much stronger. Because once the media and the attorneys feel safe that Larry Nassar is going to spend the rest of his life in jail, they're essentially going to turn all of this attention towards institutions like MSU. And you saw from the survivors today, both in court and at a press conference, that that is what they want. They say it takes an institution to enable this kind of systemic, decades-long history of abuse in which more than 100 women say that they were allegedly abused. They said that that doesn't happen with just one man. One of the women, Jessica Smith, who was there in the hearing today, she says that what she wants from MSU at this point is for them to release the internal investigation that they're doing.
The internal investigation, I feel if MSU had nothing to hide and was confident that the sole issue is the man now behind bars, then that information would have been released. And I do not feel as though I can heal completely until that information is out, until I feel that MSU is moving forward and not still holding on to the past and covering things up.
So, Kate, just to confirm, though, as of now, MSU officials have no plans to release this internal investigation to the public?
And that's what they have told me when we have talked about this directly. They say, look, we are in mediation right now with many of these women in civil lawsuits. They say it wouldn't be appropriate for us to release this. But that's not satisfying all of the critics who say that no matter what, you should put out those findings out there and let the rest of it sort itself out. And it's worth noting very briefly that there are multiple women and girls who say that over the last 20 years, they did come forward and tell somebody at MSU. Larissa Boyce says she told somebody about this in 1997. We know, of course, MSU did a Title IX investigation into Larry Nassar in 2014 and that cleared him and he was allowed to continue preying on women after that. So there's going to be quite a bit more in this case still to come.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thanksgiving is now less than a day away, and for all of you last-minute bakers out there with nothing to make, Amanda Saab has you covered. She's a no-kid hungry food blogger, founder of Dinner with Your Muslim Neighbor, and she was the first Muslim woman featured on the TV show Master Chef. The new America the Great cookbook includes Amanda's baklava cheesecake recipe. It's what she bakes for the people she loves, like her husband Hussein and their three-month-old daughter Hannah. Stateside's Lindsay Scullin recently visited Amanda's kitchen in New Boston, where a baklava cheesecake was in the works.
So I always start with the crust, and we have graham crackers and melted butter and some sugar. And it'll resemble like wet sand when you're at the Great Lakes in the summer. I wanted something that was like east and west kind of fusion together. So like the base is like traditional New York style cheesecake, while the topping is an ode to my Lebanese heritage and all the delicious Lebanese sweets that we always enjoy on holidays. So I actually started cooking and baking with my mom when I was little. She always had us in the kitchen with her, and I had like a little step stool, and she like let me like mix things, and eventually she let me crack the eggs, but not at first. And I always just loved cooking because I saw how it brought our family together and I saw how it brought friends together. And it was such a great way to show the people you love them that you love them. And what better way than with nourishment? I just loved being able to share with the people that I care about. Hi, Mom. Hi. Hannah's joining us in the kitchen. I think she's just used to all the sounds and smells of the kitchen. We're starting with the filling now. So we have four packages of full-fat cream cheese. And then we have rose water and salt and a little bit of cardamom. So we'll just crack our eggs. So standard 350. Next, we're going to start with our baklava layer. So I have my phyllo, and I let it defrost in the fridge overnight. And with working with phyllo, you kind of want to work fast, and you want to have a damp kitchen cloth. wringing it out so I don't have a lot of moisture in there. Because it will dry out because it's so thin. So you want to have some moisture to keep it nice and moist. And then I have some butter, and I'm going to melt this in the microwave really quick. So I'm just rolling out the phyllo. So we're going to take the first layer, and then we're going to brush it with butter. And then we're going to add the filling, which is ground walnuts and sugar and a little bit of cinnamon. A lot of people like to use cashews. You can use pistachios, whatever nuts you like. I think it would even be fun to do like a Thanksgiving version with pecans would be good. And if you've made baklava before, you know like how important each butter layer is in between, because that makes it nice and crispy and delicious. Oh, so good. All right, so I need some hands. When you bite into baklava, it's like nice and crisp. And the way you get that is by putting it on top instead of on the bottom. So I'm going to grab one side, and you're going to grab the other. Gently from the bottom. Bottom. Get under all the slices. Ready? Okay, perfect. All right, so we're going to pop this in the oven, but I'm going to add some boiled water. So I'm just going to get some water boiling really quickly. So we have some water, and I'm just adding it to, I just have like a loaf pan at the bottom of the oven. And you'll see right when it goes in, it will create steam into the oven. The cheesecake goes. Set your timer. Don't forget to set your timer. See you in an hour. For Thanksgiving, we'll be at my grandma's house with our family, and there'll be about 50 people there. There'll be lots of food, lots of kiddos for Hannah to play with, lots of cheesecake. So someone asked like why I chose like this recipe in particular for the cookbook. And I thought like as a American Muslim who was born and raised here, who's, you know, as American as they get, but also a practicing Muslim and proud of my Lebanese heritage, I wanted a way to reflect that in this America the Great cookbook. And I think it's pretty significant that as an American Muslim wearing hijab, that I was able to share something from my family's culture and heritage, the baklava, and then cheesecake, which I learned to make in fourth grade. And then for the pomegranate reduction, you're going to need pomegranate juice and sugar. What else? That's it. You hear like the crisp people. So perfect.
For this recipe and more from Amanda Saab, visit amandasplate.com. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How does loneliness impact our mental health? It's a question that's worth asking. Michigan State University psychiatrist Dr. Farah Abbasi believes loneliness is one of the greatest challenges we face as a society. She is with us now. Dr. Abbasi, what makes you believe that?
Thank you, Cindy. So basically, you know, I've worked at the campus for 10 years now, and this is a repetitive information I get, that the biggest challenge for our students at campus is finding that peer group, creating friendships. And I think loneliness become one of the biggest problems they are facing.
How do you define loneliness?
So culturally, if you see, with the advent of social media, all of us are more focused on our digital and technology rather than relationships and bonds. So even if you are at a family dinner, everybody is on their cell phones or on their social media. So I think socially we are becoming more isolated. But how I explain isolation is not having that comfort zone, that loving bonds or support system around you, that kind of nurture your, not only your physical sense of well-being, your physical health, but it also can have great impact on your sense of well-being, on your mental health.
Yeah, let's talk about that as far as what loneliness can do to our health, starting with physically. What about physically?
So basically what happens when you are in a loving relationship, there is an hormone, which is oxytocin, which we can, in layperson's language, call it love hormone. Oxytocin is the hormone that helps a mother bond to a child, or for a child to bond to a mother. So that's where we started studying oxytocin. But then we realized that whenever we are in social settings or people that we care for or love for, this oxytocin is released in high levels. And oxytocin can impact your mood, but also can impact your memory, your focus, your concentration. So you're performing at higher level under the effect of oxytocin. And now psychologists are realizing that even when we are under a lot of stress, this high levels of oxytocin are released because it helps us calm down, creates that sense of closeness, that sense of attachment.
So really, that loneliness affects physical and mental health.
Yes, it does.
In your experience, as you treat patients who are feeling isolated, who are battling loneliness, do you find a typical profile of someone who tends to feel isolated, tends to feel lonely?
I think we all somehow have tried to fix under certain labels or under certain boxes, right? So culturally, and especially in campus setting, I see these groups forming. It could be around similar interests. It could be around similar activities. But mostly, if you don't right away click with the group, the chances are you will find it as you go forward. You struggle to find that kind of niche. You can say, if you are not very social person, if you are a very introverted person, or if you have, high creativity levels or highly artistic, you tend to have certain taste in friendships. You find it difficult to match. But vulnerability and isolation is really high in our LGBTQ population as well. Because anytime you fear that you would be rejected or not accepted, you tend to stay away socially, and that creates that sense of isolation and then can lead to sense of alienation. And in the worst situation we see, it worsens your depression. And also when I was studying the patterns in societal behaviors, that it seems like the more lonely you are, more stronger these thoughts become, that people don't want me, I'm not worth anything, I'm a burden. And then there's high chances of you engaging in self-harming behaviors.
So it almost seems as if that feeling of loneliness or isolation, it's almost like the fire on the stove under the burner of the pot. And then that pot gets boiling, and that turns into the depression and, as you say, maybe moving on to self-harming behavior. So the fire under that burner is this loneliness.
I could not have put it any better. And we also have to now, we are living in a society where bullying has become such a reality. And we see bullying victims as young as in kindergarten or middle school, starting there. And it goes on to you can be bullied at college campuses, or later on it turns into domestic violence or intimate partner violence or aggression. So all that can deepen your sense of isolation. So you might be, like I give the example, you might be sitting in a football game, thousands of people cheering around you, and yet you feel very emotionally isolated, not understood, and that deepens your sense of depression.
So what can you help people do to break this loneliness cycle? If you're stewing in that and you're feeling like you're the only one that feels this way and you feel marginalized, how do you break that? What's the prescription, if you will?
My advice to my students always is take a step back. Instead of hiding in silos, or, a lot of these kids then tend to play video games and tend to connect through video games. So this virtual friendships have become really strong. These bonds have become strong. But I encourage them to continue to come out, keep the communication channels open. So I want them to sit down, write a list of their own interests, hobbies, people they like to hang out with, and then find similar activities at campus. So matching clubs, like if you enjoy being around animals or pets, then you can look up some veterinary support groups, or there are ways for you to connect with similar interests, or there is astronomy if you want, if you are interested in something like that, go find that club. If you like to, you know, be creative writing or artistic groups. So there are all these groups available. It's just having that strength and courage to step out and break this cycle of isolation.
Let's take it off campus and talk to people that are listening to us really all over Michigan who may be going to work, going about their lives, living within their families, but they feel alone. How do you help yourself out of that?
So one thing I'm really concerned with the holiday season coming, those of us who do not have close family members living close by or don't have family in the country.
How about feeling even alone within your own family?
Right. You can even feel alone, and then holidays become an extra stress. I would say still the same thing is finding your tribe, finding your people. So even if you are doing stuff with the holiday, with the family, and you feel you are not accepted or you don't feel connected, so then create that time for yourself where you can hang out with that one person, two person, or clubs or activities that you feel validated in. And there are a lot of activities out there. It's just a matter of finding them and connecting and having the courage to do it. But one thing I really definitely want to emphasize on, one thing I see is this isolation rates and having a really detrimental effect on our geriatric populations. You know, our grandparents or older population that's living in nursing home. So in their case, it's not only emotional isolation, but it's also there's no sensory stimulation left for them. They are sitting just in front of televisions, watching hours and hours of, you know, these TV programs without really getting any sensory stimulation. And that actually impacts their memory and cause dementia, or worsen dementia and depression both. So maybe if you are a lonely person and you might not find connections with your age group, this is a good time to visit nursing homes. Because another thing is, whenever you are volunteering and trying to going beyond your own suffering and pain, you are able to help someone else, which in turn actually helps you feel better.
Yes, stop looking at the mirror and look out is what you're saying.
Yes, because I think one thing we have to understand is when we are sitting alone with our thoughts, we tend to believe that we are the only ones going through the situation and we are the only ones suffering. But there are many out there who are doing worse than we are, who we can reach out and help. It could be somebody suffering from chronic illness. It could be a family who has suffered recent loss. We have had some huge natural calamities in the country. We have had some horrible shooting incidences. There are so many families and people and individuals suffering out there. You have homelessness in your own town. You have 1 in 4 kids going hungry. So this is the time to go beyond and connect. Keep these connections going. Keep the communications open. And that's the only way for us to fight this epidemic of isolation.
Dr. Farha Abbasi, Michigan State University psychiatrist. As always, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Cindy.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
When the Detroit Lions host the Vikings tomorrow, they're continuing a Michigan tradition that goes back further than many of us can remember. Exactly how and when did this Thanksgiving Day football tradition get started? Joining us now is our partner at the Michigan History Center, State Archivist Mark Harvey. Welcome back, Mark.
It is good to be back.
So a lot of people know the Detroit Lions started playing on Thanksgiving sometime back in the 1930s, but Michigan's football and turkey tradition actually goes back even further?
It does. The University of Michigan made it a tradition back in the 19th century, starting around 1885. They were playing Thanksgiving Day games against the University of Chicago Maroons, and they made it so consistent that those games have been credited as the beginning of Thanksgiving Day football. I mean, the truth is there were lots of other places doing it, but not as consistently as Chicago and the University of Michigan.
And you stop and you think, my goodness, that was just 20 years after the end of the Civil War.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing and remarkable. I think another interesting tidbit from that series of games is that in a game in Chicago in 1898, a music major, Louis Elbel, was on hand to witness Michigan's 12-11 victory. Sounds like more like a baseball score than a football score.
It does.
But yeah, that game inspired him, his train ride back from Chicago, begin composing the song The Victors.
Aha.
And so that, you know, that Thanksgiving Day tradition helped inspire the fight song for the University of Michigan. People always wonder, I think, myself, I wondered what the champions of the West really was all about. And that's the reference to them having won the Western Conference championship for the first time in the school's history. So he was extra excited that year.
So now anybody who's at the Big House on any given Saturday and hears that knows where that started, Thanksgiving Day, when they became the champions of the West.
Right.
So fast forward us to the 1930s. How did this brand new team, fairly brand new team calling itself the Detroit Lions, begin its Thanksgiving tradition?
Well, there was a new owner named George A. Richards, who had brought the Lions from Portsmouth, Ohio, brought them up to Detroit, and they were actually quite good. In 1934, they were undefeated before the Thanksgiving Day game that materialized, but the attendance was really lagging. And Richards, the innovator, saw having a Thanksgiving Day game as a way to isolate the attention of the fans. Now, again, it wasn't the very first time a professional team played on the day, but what Richards did that was different was he took it nationwide. He convinced NBC to broadcast the game nationwide, thus instilling that tradition across the country, not just in specific locations. And Detroit met the undefeated and defending champion Chicago Bears that first year in 1934 and lost 19-16, but a tradition was born.
Then it continued, but then the Lions took a six-year break from 1939 through 1944. And we know that years 42, 43, 44, well, that was because of World War II. But 1939, 1940, and 41, that was about the national controversy at the time, some disparagingly called Franksgiving. What was going on then?
Yeah, Franksgiving. And I must admit, I was not aware of Franksgiving before we looked at the story a little deeper. Briefly, Thanksgiving was celebrated on the last Thursday of November since around 1863, per the instructions of President Abraham Lincoln. And on the heels of the Depression in 1939, President Roosevelt actually had pressure from the retailers to extend the holiday shopping season. So even then, people were trying to extend the holiday shopping season. It's not just now.
Good point.
Yeah. Surprisingly, he gave in to this pressure and went ahead and declared that they were going to move the Thanksgiving holiday to the third Thursday. Well, it didn't really sit well, and it wasn't a national holiday at this point, so it could not be enforced nationwide. So while that was the direction, each state was left to decide their own holiday, and not surprisingly, it split along political lines. Yeah, around 22 states went with Roosevelt's plan, 23 stuck with the old date, and then the rest celebrated both.
Oh, two go-rounds.
Yeah, right. They really like turkey. What it did was it wreaked havoc with scheduling. So for those 2 years that this was observed, there was not an official Thanksgiving Day game. In fact, the only teams that played were teams from Pittsburgh and Philadelphia because they observed the same holiday, obviously, in the same state. So those two teams played in 39 and 40. And then in 41, with the looming World War, even though Pearl Harbor hadn't happened yet, they had decided to shorten the season in 41. So that's why we don't have a game in 1941. In 1941 is when we actually decided that Franksgiving wasn't the best idea, and it was declared a national holiday, which is now the fourth Thursday of the month.
Okay. We get through World War II, wrap that up by August of 1945, and that's when the Lions were back to hosting a game every Thanksgiving since. But eventually another team jumped on that Thanksgiving bandwagon, right?
They did. The Dallas Cowboys began hosting the second game in 1966. And interestingly, the state of Texas had only resolved recognizing the fourth Thursday federal holiday 5 years prior to that.
And is it true the NFL was considering taking the Thanksgiving Day game away from the Detroit Lions?
Alas, it's true, because the Lions were just so bad. And around 2008, in the midst of an underwhelming season at that point, they were 0-11 coming up on their annual Thanksgiving Day game. They actually lost 47-10 to the Tennessee Titans that year. And it really got people talking about the fact that it doesn't seem right that we have this one team have the Thanksgiving Day game reserved, and they're just awful. So media and others started clamoring for there to be some changes in the scheduling to give other more successful teams a chance to play on Thanksgiving.
Michigan radio sports commentator John U. Bacon was telling me when he was here yesterday, he said, it isn't often that the Ford family really stands up to the NFL and basically says, get lost, but this time they surely did. They really pushed back.
And then also there's some other changes in the NFL, not the least of which the Lions actually start getting a little bit better. It's hard not to get better after going 0-16.
No, that's true.
But they got better, and the NFL made changes. They actually added a third game on Thanksgiving Day, which rotates around all the other teams. And then they also introduced the Thursday night primetime game. So now every team has an opportunity to play on a Thursday, whether it's Thanksgiving or not.
That's state archivist Mark Harvey from the Michigan History Center. Mark, thank you so much for taking us forward down the history field and explaining how the Detroit Lions Thanksgiving Day game became a tradition. And a happy Thanksgiving to you, Mark.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you.
After the break, telling a mother's life story with linoleum. We'll speak with artist Carl Wilson. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Isn't it funny how the smallest details about a loved one can stay with us for a long, long time? For example, a scent. Any whiff of Shalimar instantly makes me think of my great Aunt Vern because it was her signature perfume. For artist Carl Wilson, it's the memory of the chewing gum his mom always had in her purse. And that led to the title of his first solo museum exhibition. Carl Wilson, Her Purse Smelled Like Juicy Fruit and Other Tales, runs through February 11th at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. His linocut prints and writing tell the life story of his mother. This Detroit artist is a former auto worker. He's received a Kresge Artist Fellowship. He's been an artist in residence at the famed Yaddo Artist Community in Saratoga Springs, New York, and much more. Carl Wilson, pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Hi, Cynthia. Thank you.
So you work in prints, books, and film, but this exhibition is of your linoleum prints. Would you describe to us just what a linoleum print is and what the look is?
Linoleum printing is one of the most simple forms of impression printing. I take a sheet of common linoleum, and when I first started, I was using this hard stuff that was very similar to what was on your floor. Of course, now I'm using something a lot softer. You take a knife, you carve away the parts of the linoleum that you want to appear white on the paper. You create an image. Roll it over with ink, goes through a press, or you use a baron of some kind to make the impression, transfer it to paper.
And it gives a very powerful and stark image. Is that what appealed to you?
Definitely. I always work in black and white. There are some printers that like to introduce color, but right away I discovered that black and white is what did it for me. It tells the story very dramatically.
How long might it take to do a print?
Well, when I first started, it would take days to carve the print. But when I did a residency at Yaddo in New York, thrust under different working conditions, and all of a sudden, I was making a print a day.
Wow. And the detailing is amazing. And actually, while you were at Yaddo is when you did these, I understand?
Yes. Yeah. The whole thing was done during a 2 week stay at Yaddo. I went there not really sure what I was going to do. and I wandered around the woods out there. Yaddo is a tremendous place. It sits on 400 acres in upstate New York, and there's all this isolation. Now, I have to admit, I love television. I am hopelessly addicted. So I get out in the woods of New York, and I find out up here there's no television.
Aha. Uh-huh.
There's no internet. There's not even phone service. Most of it, you can go to the library and get these things. But there's all this time to think. And I had already been turning over my family connections. And it really just occurred to me that I didn't know my mom. And I wanted to know her. So I spent time trying to recall all these stories about my mom, the few things that I had heard. And I was able to finally piece together an understandable image of her. I got why she did what she did.
Now, tell me a little about your mom and also why it seems like you felt like you said, I didn't know my mom.
Well, that's the whole thing. I can only tell you a very little about my mom. She was so secretive. I just gave up early. I would ask her questions like, one of the first things I can remember is, hey, Mom, how old are you? And she would glance around the room to see if there was anybody there. And she'd say, can you keep a secret? And I'd say, yeah, sure I can. She'd look around again. She'd say, I can too. So she never yes. told me how old she was. She never told me much about her family, her background, what she had done.
Why do you think that was? Was that the generation? Do you think that was her era?
I certainly think it was the generation. Today, I think parents are typically spilling their guts to their kids.
They almost too much sometimes.
Everything, yeah. You know. And back then, no, you didn't do that. Parents' business was their business. And if you found out something, it was because you needed to know it.
Yeah. So you started thinking about it and creating these beautiful, powerful liner cut images of your mother's life. What's her name?
Louise.
I saw that name in one of the titles. Right. And the idea is to document lives that perhaps aren't famous, aren't celebrity lives, but are compelling, like your mom's?
Sure. This became important to me because of my background. Now, very foolishly, at the age of 21, I joined a cult, and that turned out to be a disaster, of course. Once I was in the cult, I was completely indoctrinated with the idea that my life wasn't worth much, that I wasn't worth much. I was completely unimportant. All people were unimportant. The only thing that mattered was doing the creator's will and the will of the cult leaders. So, amazingly, about 3 years into my life in the cult, I realized this is not for me. But I remained another 27 years because it's that hard to get out. They have you completely brainwashed. You think, if I were to leave this, I'm going to die. I'm going to lose all of my friends, all my connections, and furthermore, God's going to be so displeased with me, he'll destroy me.
Even though you had this internal dissension, you knew that this wasn't for you. You knew it wasn't right, but you didn't know how to get out.
Didn't know how to get out, afraid to leave. And in fact, in some ways, I'm still afraid. I don't publicly even name the cult because I fear reprisals.
Did they cut you off from your mother?
Yes, they did. They suggested that you have absolutely nothing to do with any non-believer. So I was totally discouraged from seeing my siblings, my mother, my father, everybody. All old friends, you just
Are you making up lost ground with these prints?
Oh, definitely. The prints are therapy for me. It's a way of confronting all of the past, finally dealing with it, trying to put it to rest.
Well, I'm looking at some of these just little copies that I printed off of your website, carlwilsonart.com. boy, you need Jesus. And you're laughing. And let me try to describe. There's a little fellow wearing Converse sneakers, jeans rolled up, striped shirt, sitting in front of a TV set with the rabbit ears, so we know that kind of dates it. And a lady wearing a nurse's uniform and a nurse's cap and carrying a book, perhaps the Bible, is yanking this kid by his right ear and kind of pulling him back. And the look on his face is priceless. And I think most of us can relate to being corrected by our parents. Tell us about Boy, You Need Jesus.
Well, I grew up in a household that was typically African-American. And my mom had strong roots in the Baptist church. Her parents made her go to church. And so this is just our tradition. I didn't want any part of this. I wanted to stay home on a Sunday and watch Three Stooges on TV. Mom wasn't having it, okay?
Boy, you need Jesus.
Yeah, that's a pretty much literal interpretation of what was happening at my house.
Very much. Now there's another one that's just so striking. It shows a huge man wearing, appears to be a football jersey. It says Joy with a big zero on the back. Looks like he's bald, looming over a very fierce-looking little lady with a tiny child behind, terrified clearly because you see one terrified eye peeking around the lady, Mama, right? And Mama's pointing a finger at this big fella wearing this jersey, and it's titled Giant Killer. What's this about?
It was really hard to create this print because I never talked about it before. And when I was a kid in junior high school, just got to junior high school, it's the seventh grade, I experienced abuse at the hands of a teacher. We had a gym teacher that for some reason thought that appropriate punishment for a class was going into the shower room while everyone was naked, lining them up, and having them pass through while he took a big wooden paddle and swatted everybody. And this was traumatic, to say the least.
Traumatic, as you tell me. I can't imagine going through it.
Well, I wouldn't tell my mom about it. And I just tried to hold this as a secret. And it got harder and harder to go to school because this was happening on a regular basis. And Mom figured out that something was wrong. I don't know how she did it.
Parental radar.
We did not talk about things. That was the common thing in our house. We don't discuss anything. But somehow, Mom knew that there was something wrong. She not only knew something was wrong, she figured out pretty much what the problem was. So she goes back to school, and she confronts this teacher. Now, Louise Wilson was 4'9" tall. And my gym teacher was a huge hulking man. And I tell you, she lit into him. And I was terrified. She didn't shrink at all. And he was getting angry, but he took it all from her. He just let her tell him off. And I'm there watching. And he looked at me. He never touched me again.
Wow, the giant killer. It's a tremendous print. And another one that really got me is Goodbye. And it's you holding her in her hospital bed, I'm sure, because you can see its wheels. It's a very stark light around it. And you are cradling her like a baby. We all have to say that goodbye to someone as they cross over, as they walk over. The time comes for all of us.
Yeah, that's a print that I never look at anymore. Never read the description, and will not read it publicly anymore. Mom and I didn't talk a lot, never did. But when I got the call that she was in the hospital, she'd had a massive heart attack, in fact, a series of them, and that she wasn't going to make it, I should come to the hospital. So I rushed to the hospital, couple of my brothers were already there. My sister was there. And mom was in the room and very uncomfortable, really squirming. She was in tremendous pain from these heart attacks. And I was determined, I'm not going to well up right now. I went over to her and I held her. And she looked at me and said, "I love you, son." She'd never told me that my entire life. And I told her I loved her too. And then she passed.
And you put that into this print, and it is a powerful and emotional print, and how you got that out of linoleum, but that emotion's in that print.
I had to do this. One of the reasons goes back to the cult, and that was saying that what I thought, what I felt didn't matter. And I knew deep inside that that can't possibly be true. We do matter to each other. And the idea that my mom had always kept me safe, always protected me. We had some complicated situations. My dad was a paranoid schizophrenic. There was a certain element of danger in our household. Mom kept us safe. She realized that I was a very sensitive child, and she did what she thought she needed to do to toughen me up, to make me be able to survive a cold, cruel world. So I determined I gotta say something. There's too many people that go through life thinking I'm inconsequential, I don't matter. We all have something to say. My artwork is about telling other people's stories. Now, this time, I guess I told my story, but it's really her story. But we need to listen to each other. We need to notice what we all feel.
More than ever today.
And care about that. That more than ever, people have just turned off their fellow human. We're so insensitive to what happens to our fellow human. And that is the cruelest thing that you could imagine.
Well, these prints are really worth going to see at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. Carl Wilson's exhibition running through February 11th, 2018. Her Purse Smelled Like Juicy Fruit and Other Tales. You can get a sense of his work by going to his website, carlwilsonart.com. And beautiful work, very powerful. And you got me. You got me good. So you're right. We do need to pay attention to each other's lives because there's much to learn, and you realize you're not in it alone.
True. Thank you. Thank you. I've got to continue with this. I keep seeing people's stories that are compelling. I did a series of prints. It started in the mid-2000s, you know, about a neighborhood in Detroit that refused to die. It had been overrun by crime, poverty, and this one block, Parkhurst, had been inhabited by all these artists and writers and social activists, and they were determined, we're going to make this neighborhood survive. So I started telling these stories. Now, in this neighborhood, there were a lot of sex workers. And these transgender sex workers were being attacked regularly. There's, you know, it's a dangerous business to begin with, but there was a killer running wild there, and I was able to document some of their stories too. These unheard voices need to be heard, and it's my humble mission to try to do this.
Carl Wilson, thank you for sharing your work and your talents with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Danny Henzel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and have a very, very happy Thanksgiving.